Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to today's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. It's the show that aims to get you thinking and brings you conversations that matter every single week. And welcome back to our Summer of Science, continuing today with a discussion on intelligent design. We'll also hear your recent feedback to shows including Stephen C. Meyer and Brian Keating and Sabina Hossenfelder and Luke Barnes on the universe and fine-tuning. That's all coming up towards the end of today's show. And I'll be telling you about some recent interviews I've been able to have with other podcasters too. But for now, if you want more from the show, do make sure to check us out at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for the show archive, for videos, newsletters, and ways to support us. Right now, let's get into today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today on the show, we're looking at why one person does and why another doesn't endorse intelligent design. That's our subject today. Returning to this topic of intelligent design with Dr. Joshua Swamidas. He's a computational biologist, author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve. And that aims to reconcile a standard evolutionary view of human origins with the Genesis accounts. Now, last time he came on the show, it was opposite a well-known ID advocate, Mike Behe, to debate whether the microscopic machinery of our cells are better explained by intelligent design or evolution. But today, he's back to engage with Dr. Gunter Beckley, a paleoentomologist who specialises in fossil history. Now, Gunter is a senior fellow with Discovery Institute's Centre for Science and Culture, and he believes the fossil record is better explained by intelligent design than Darwinian evolution. And Gunter's explicit that he takes that stance, not for any religious reasons, but on the basis of the best science. So today we'll be finding out why Gunter sides with intelligent design and Joshua doesn't. So welcome along to the programme, both Gunter and Joshua. Before we hear your cases, let's meet you both again briefly. First of all, Gunter, first time on the show, but I've heard of you and read your stuff before now. You haven't always been a Christian, have you? Obviously, Joshua was raised in a Christian environment, but you came to it in adult years. What could you describe what you did describe yourself as and how that changed for you?
Sure. So I was not raised as a Christian, not raised as a believer. My parents were agnostics or atheists. We actually didn't really talk about this stuff. I was not baptized, never went to some kind of religious education, never went to church as kid. And when I was, let's say, old enough intellectually to think about these questions, I self-identified as an atheist. And I had heroes like Richard Dawkins. That was basically, I had a relatively simple view on religion, the standard ideas of, let's say, the new atheist, that this is all some kind of medieval superstition and is nonsense. And I came to believe not in the usual way. It came in a long intellectual journey, which started with a kind of popular science interest in modern physics. And then I encountered problems that cannot be easily explained by materialism or naturalism. And then I started a kind of worldview quest. And this led me to over 10 or 15 years to different views, which I held then for some years, and then I gave them up because they turned out to be inconsistent. And ultimately, I arrived at some kind of generic theism as best explanation, and then I had some incentive to look into religions and to explore the particular claims, let's say, of Judaism or Christianity or Islam. And then to my great surprise, because I had no prior, let's say, kind of confirmation bias that I wanted to find Christianity to be true, rather the opposite. I didn't really like Christianity, so I was surprised to find the historical reliability of the Gospels quite well supported and the historicity of the resurrection. And so I came, in a way, against my will to a Christian belief.
Thanks for sharing that story, Gunter. Jesus is good, isn't he?
I'd love to dig that into that more another day, maybe, but we'll restrict ourselves to the science and how it relates, I suppose, to Christianity at some level today. Josh, I think this must be your third time on the show, and we're going to get you back for another discussion with William Lane Craig as well on the historical Adam and Eve. But how's the book been received now? It's been over a year, I think, since it's been released. Have you been pleased with the kinds of responses?
I've been really excited about how it's really opened up conversations in surprising ways. I think I've always said that I don't think evolution is the whole story, and people weren't really sure what it meant by that. But I do think that there's a real legitimacy to the record that we have in Scripture, and I think that people are seeing that there's a way to hold those things together. And the conversation at the Evangelical Theological Society was really strong, as was it in the American Academy for Religion, and then also the one coming up in ASA, I'm very much looking to, the American Scientific Affiliation. And I think one of the key things to see is how scholars are responding to it. There's been a few academic papers that have come out, but and already a couple books, but probably the most important book, because of its readership and its impact, is Bill Craig's book coming out in September, where he's kind of explaining how he pulls it all together. In large part interacting with my work too.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to bringing you both together for a conversation on that in a month or two. But in the meantime, we're talking about intelligent design on the show today. And what I thought we'd do at the outset is give you both a bit of time to you know, put out your position. Why don't we start with Gunter and take it away, Gunter, and tell us why you do endorse intelligent design.
Right. So maybe before I start, it's always good to define some terms to not talking past each other. I suppose Josh will do the same. So what do I mean when I say Darwinism? So I don't mean common descent with modification or the tree of life, which I'm happy to affirm. I mean with Darwinism, basically a purely accidental material process of undirected transformation. And that would be especially natural selection acting on random mutation. So that would be neo-Darwinism. And that this is a sufficient explanation of macroevolution. That's what I mean with Darwinism. And the other term, design, what do I mean with design? And I don't mean with this necessarily a theological idea of, let's say, supernatural, miraculous intervention of God, but basically an infusion of information from outside of the system as best scientific explanation of the empirical data. So that would be the two terms. And we will see, actually, from what I've seen from Josh, that we have a lot in common. Josh and I, we're both Christian theists. We think that God created the universe and that he even created humans by whatever means. We are both bioscientists. We both believe in an old earth and in common descent with modification, including our own species. And we both support Darwinian and non-Darwinian evolution in terms of microevolution. And we both even seem to agree, if I don't have misunderstood Josh, that natural selection acting on random mutation is not a sufficient theory of macroevolution. So where do we disagree? So Josh thinks that other undirected processes, like, for example, neutral evolution, have superseded neo-Darwinism and that they can do the job. And I don't think that this is correct. I think that neo-Darwinism is far from dead, that is very much alive in evolutionary biology. And there are, of course, other new ideas, but Darwin's idea of this process of selection and random mutation is the only idea in 2,000 years of Western civilization that has ever been proposed to explain the origin of specified complexity from simple beginnings by a purely naturalistic bottom-up process. So we mainly disagree on the question of the adequacy and sufficiency of an unguided or undirected process of macroevolution. So now, of course, even though I'm a Christian now, like Josh, even though I have become a Christian late in life, this has been totally irrelevant, as you already indicated, for my position. So I have come to doubt Darwinism for purely scientific reasons and only became a Christian and a theist many years later. But of course, now, I still don't have theological reasons to reject Darwinism and embrace idea. I'm happy, would be happy with it in terms of biblical interpretation. So I just think that Darwinism has failed as the best scientific explanation of the data. And of course, after becoming a Christian, now I would interpret the results from intelligent design research in terms of God being the designer. And Josh probably even would agree with that. He even doesn't exclude that God might have guided the history of life, but he thinks that science cannot show this, at least in biology. He thinks that intelligent design has failed as a kind of scientific argument. And I, on the other hand, think that there's good empirical evidence for intelligent design. So what evidence was it that convinced me? There's, of course, not a single, let's say, smoking gun evidence. It's more or less a cumulative argument. And it's a mixture of arguments that, on the one hand, show that the undirected processes are not feasible as explanation. And on the other hand, there's positive evidence for design as best explanation. So some of the evidences that convinced me initially are the classical arguments that have been brought forth for intelligent design. So it's, for example, the problem of the origin of life and of the first replicator, which are required to get this whole Darwinian process started in the first place. So they cannot be explained with Darwinism. And another is this combinatorial search space problem to get new protein folds, this rarity of islands of function in the search space. The digital code in DNA, this information problem where you find design patterns like redundancy and distributed information and data compression and error correction and name it. And then, of course, irreducible complexity, which was an idea originally suggested by Charles Darwin himself, and which is very prominent, especially in molecular machines like the bacterial flagellum. And then also causal circularity in certain processes in metabolism, like the origin of ATP, where you need basically the end product to make it. And you have this kind of chicken egg problem. But most of all, of course, it has been evidence from my own field of expertise, and that is the fossil record and paleontology. And what we find there is fossil discontinuities as a rule in all periods of Earth history, in all groups of organisms. It's not just the Cambrian explosion or the abrupt origin of flowering plants, which were called an abominable mystery by Darwin. He was bothered by this. He was already aware of this because it contradicts his indispensable assumption or prediction of gradualism, and it can no longer be explained away as an artifact of an incomplete fossil record. And these abrupt appearances of new body plans, they also imply saltational transitions. And these saltations are incompatible with an undirected bottom-up process. That's why Darwin insisted so much on gradualism and had this Latin dictum, natura non facit saltos, nature doesn't make jumps. So saltations rather imply a top-down design. And they also imply a genetic problem that is a so-called waiting time problem. So the windows of time that are established by the fossil record for certain transitions, let's say from terrestrial ancestors to fully marine whales, they are orders of magnitude too short to accommodate the waiting times to get and spread the required genetic changes that are necessary for these re-engineerings that are implied by these transitions. And this can be simply calculated with the standard apparatus of population genetics. So these two fields of inference conflict, population genetics and fossil and the fossil record, even though many people might think that they support Darwinism. And finally, there's a strange phenomenon. If we look at the divergence times based on molecular clock as estimates of recent species pairs and compare it with past macroevolutionary transitions on the same time scale. So, for example, from Pachycetus to a fully marine whale like Basilosaurus, then we do not find any recent species that show on the same time scale of divergence a remotely comparable morphological disparity. So, of course, you could ask why inferring design instead of just saying we don't know. It's basically because we know by our observation of the universe that there's only one known cause for this sudden increase of specified information, and that's the causal activity of intelligent agents. It's the only known cause. And so we can infer intelligent causation in terms of a inference to the best explanation. Because these structures in biology have certain hallmarks of design, and everybody, even Richard Dawkins, agrees that biology looks designed. It looks, to use a metaphor of Josh, it looks more like Mount Rushmore, not like Mount Everest. And I would say when something looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then probably it is a duck. And that's why I endorse intelligent design as a scientist.
Wow. Well, thank you. That was a really helpful and, you know, fully concise and yet, you know, very, very broad sort of a summary of why you endorse intelligent design. I'm sure we'll get into those issues of the waiting time and the fossil record and everything. We won't be able to cover everything that you mentioned, though, in that presentation. Okay, Josh, let's hand over to you. And you've had very friendly conversations with people, both on the sort of atheist naturalist end of the spectrum and those on the intelligent design and creationist end as well of the spectrum. So tell us about why you specifically have not been persuaded by intelligent design and what sort of evolutionary process you do think makes sense of the science.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about that. And thanks for having me too. Gunter, thank you also for coming and talking with me. I'm looking forward to kind of working this out. I think the way you approach this is really helpful by trying to explain where you thought where I was coming from. And I thought your explanation was pretty good, though. There is one or two points that I think it might be helpful to clarify, because I think really what the real benefit of dialogue between us is to kind of clarify where the agreements and disagreements are. And I actually would think for as overall, you know, high level view, I think you really hit on what the key things are. I think it really does come down to a scientific disagreement, and we actually have a great deal of agreement. And I think that that's important to map out and explain as people are watching this, because they may not be able to follow all the ins and outs of all the scientific arguments, but at least they can know where the action is and where the agreements and disagreements lie. And I also have questions for you too, just about if I'm getting it right and understanding it, both for you specifically, but more about the movement as a whole and my relationship to it, and why, and also to just get more specification on particular things you said. Does that make sense, Gunter?
Yeah, sure.
All right, great. So I think starting out with defining terms makes a lot of sense here. And what I mean by evolution is really similar to what you just said, common descent, which is the idea that common descent with modifications is how the majority of diversity on Earth arises, or all of it. And what you're making a distinction is between evolution, which is common descent, which you don't have a problem with the idea of Darwinism, which is undirected, and natural selection acting on random mutation. Is that right, Gunter?
Yeah. Or okay. Generally undirected processes of whatever kind.
So I guess the issue I would have with that is that it seems to be a bit of a conflation, because Darwinism could mean either that or that, but those are still different definitions. And And I think it's very clear that there are other mechanisms in addition to random mutation and natural selection. You said that there's been no other mechanism proposed. That's not true in my reading of it. I think that there are other mechanisms. They wouldn't be directed as the way you're understanding it. So that would still be Darwinism, even though it's more than natural mutation. I mean, a natural selection acting on random mutation. Is that a good way? I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. We can talk about the other processes if they have superseded neo-Darwinism.
Yeah, we can talk about them all, but I think that if you're going to try and argue against directed evolution, undirected evolution, and the only conception you have of undirected evolution is natural selection answering on random mutations, well, then it's going to be a bit of a straw man argument from the get-go.
No, we can talk about it. The point is that I meant with this restriction is that I have reasons why all the other processes cannot explain the explanatory deficits of neo-Darwinism. So I don't think that it's true that there are any other processes that could...
I would just prefer to keep those two different definitions separate, recognizing that you mean undirected. You don't mean only natural selection versus random mutation. I would also just add, too, that it's a bit more difficult to explain what you mean by undirected, because ID advocates themselves have made clear that that it could have been preloading. I'm not advocating for preloading. I have no problem with the idea of God infusing information or miraculously creating species or whatever. But it still would be a design theory to say it was all preloaded.
Sure,
and that
sure.
wouldn't be directed evolution, right?
Right, right. No disagreement here. I would be open for both possibilities, a preloaded possibility, kind of fine-tuning.
Yeah, so it really seems to be is whether... Well, yeah, so that's the issue there. I mean, and later on, I do really want to hear what you mean precisely by an infusion of information.
Right.
Because technically... most scientists would say that evolution is directed. It's directed by the environment. It's directed by natural selection. Natural selection does provide a directionality to evolution. So observing directionality isn't enough to conclude that there had to be an external infusion beyond what's gotten from the environment. But I'm willing to go with that terminology, but recognizing that technically... what's actually being proposed by science is directed evolution. It's just not the type of direction you're talking about. Now, that being said...
I would disagree, but we can talk about it.
Yeah, well, that being said, the one point where I think you did misunderstand what I said is I'm not actually arguing that purely natural mechanisms are sufficient. I don't know if that's okay. I would say that I'm a really agnostic there, and I would actually be inclined to say that no, they're not. I would just say that the natural processes are a very useful scientific tool for understanding what's going on. But they're not total. They don't really rule out other processes in general. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. And by the way, when you're saying about evolution, as I just described it, is just common to something compatible, we're not unique in thinking that. Also, Michael Behe affirms this. Also, does Michael Beckley. There's also several people in ID that don't affirm common descent, but would agree that common descent is not necessarily in conflict with design. And I think from a theological point of view, this is where the biggest challenges come, not because of common descent or the Cambrian explosion, but what's going on up here at the very top with humans and apes. I think that's really where the big theological problems come for Christians. But I think there's an immense amount of evidence for that. And at some point, it'd be great to hear why you're convinced of some of that evidence, particularly for human evolution. All right, so I think this is where we agree. We agree on the age of the Earth, on common descent. We both agree that Darwinism isn't really sufficient, or science hasn't demonstrated even that purely natural evolution is sufficient. I don't think it can do that. And I think we agree on the incompleteness of science alone. And I think we also agree on the dialogue on the need for dialogue across disagreements. And in fact, my conversations with you, Gunter, have been really positive. I really enjoy getting to know you. And I think that there could be a lot gained from us hashing out, even if we're going to disagree in the end, just clarifying where we agree and why, and where we disagree and why. And I think it really does come down to these two issues, I think. I know you're not going to like the first one, and this may not apply to you, because I don't actually know if you take a confrontational approach, but Doug Axe in Undeniable, and also in the recent Crossway book on theistic evolution, he talks about how there's a need to have a confrontational approach to evolutionary science. And I don't think that that's actually effective, even if ID is correct. I think a conversational approach is better than a confrontational approach, because it's much more likely to bring people over to understand the arguments that are being made and help them move over to a different position. A lot of ID does seem to be oriented around a confrontational approach. You might be an exception to this, Gunter, but this does make me really concerned. Even if ID was correct, it seems that the approach that's often taken really undermines ID among the scientific community.
What do you say to that, Gunter? Would you describe your approach as confrontational or conversational or something
else? No, and actually we would have to talk what he means with confrontational approach, because to me it sounds like an approach, oh, we don't like the science, or we want to oppose this for some non-scientific reasons. I think that's nonsense. In science, we look at different evidences for different explanations, and then we look what is the best explanation for the available data. And if we...
I'm just going off. The word confrontational is directly from Doug. Yeah. That's how he describes himself. He thinks that it needs to be... So I'm not interpreting him. I'm saying that he thinks that evolution needs to be confronted. And he argues specifically against Bill Craig's non-confrontational approach to it.
Yeah, but even Bill Craig there, says that it's to best to find out because everybody is a human, and also ID proponents have, let's say, other opinions. So the question is, did he say this, let's say, from a theological perspective, which would be something totally different and has no direct necessary correlation with ID theory? Then, of course, it can be that somebody has some theological reason to have a confrontational approach to evolution because people think this brings people out of the faith or whatever. But from a scientific
side, I think he was arguing. Have you read that chapter in Undeniable?
Pardon?
Have you read Doug Axe's statements about a confrontational approach and why you think this is important?
I've read the book, but I don't remember this particular issue of confrontational approach, so you would have to update me on this.
So, I'll grant you this, Gunter. I don't actually see that in quite the same way with you, so I'm not trying to apply that term to you, if that makes sense.
Well, let's maybe leave it for the moment, because we probably need Doug Axe here to tell us exactly what he meant by a confrontational approach. We are just running up against our first break. So why don't we...
I think it really comes down to the validity of specific arguments where the disagreement is. And we can get into them, but I think it really is just a scientific disagreement where, you know, ultimately you might even be correct on certain points, Gunter, and some certain conclusions. I'm just not sure if the arguments that are being made for those conclusions are valid. Does that make sense?
Let's get into those.
That makes sense, arguments. And I'm happy to be incorrect. Then even then, scientific understanding progresses. So I don't need to be correct. The important thing is what is true.
Well, let's get into some of those arguments in the next section of today's show. We're talking about intelligent design on today's program. Why Gunter Beckley endorses it? Why he became, you know, an advocate of intelligent design, especially because of his view on the fossil record and the way he doesn't believe that a Darwinian evolutionary process explains that well enough, and sort of in defense of an evolutionary Christian view is my other guest, Joshua Swamidas, today on the show, and we'll be back very shortly.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking about intelligent design on Unbelievable today. Last time we did sort of intelligent design in the cosmos with Stephen C. Meyer. Back this week with Dr. Gunter Beckley, who's a paleoentomologist who specializes in fossil history. And he says, as far as he can see, for a whole number of different reasons, but especially in the fossil record, there's a better explanation in terms of intelligent design than the Darwinian evolutionary model. Opposite Gunther today is Joshua Swamidas, computational biologist, author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve. And he's arguing that we can reconcile a sort of standard evolutionary view, really, with the science and with the Christian account of our origins as well. But, I mean, you've said from the outset, Gunther, that it's not a religious issue for you. And, I, you know, Joshua outlined a number of areas where he thinks you do have a level of agreement, things like the age of the Earth and also common descent with biomodification. Now, I suppose it's the details is where the intelligent design issue comes out, isn't it? So do you want to explain why you can perhaps agree on those sorts of things, but still hold a very different view about the details of intelligent design?
Sure, because it's always in science there's room for disagreement about the data and the best interpretation of the data. And of course, there's even in physics, which is the queen of sciences, we have different schools of thought in terms of interpretation or quantum mechanics or how to interpret space-time or whatever. So it's not like science is just one enterprise where all people agree and everybody who disagrees is outside of the realm of science. There is room for disagreement. And so one of the issues that Josh brought up is this question of why limiting this whole thing to this issue of Darwinism, of random mutation and natural selection. And I have seen some of his other talks where he said, well, Darwinism is dead since 100 years and neo-Darwinism is dead since the 1960s. And we moved beyond it. And there was Kimura in the 68 with the neutral evolution. The reason why I think that is really crucial to focus on this process of random mutation, natural selection are several. One is that there is a reason why Richard Dawkins said only Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, or why Daniel Dennett called it Darwin's dangerous idea. There is no thought in 2,000 years of history of Western civilization, how could we explain complexity from simple beginnings by a bottom-up process? And if we look at all the other processes that Josh alluded to, so neutral evolution or different processes of the so-called extended synthesis, they can't explain those issues. And that's not just my opinion. So just to give you an idea, if we look at neo-Darwinism, it's far from that. And it's not only my colleagues in evolutionary biology, everybody, I don't know a single one who would say that Darwinism in the terms of this definition of random mutation, natural selection, is not the main process. But even if we look at a very recent paper just published 17 May 2021, by Hancock in the journal Evolution, Modern Synthesis is very much alive. From the abstract, the modern synthesis, that's neo-Darwinism, remains the foundation of evolutionary theory. Neo-Darwinism is alive and well. And I attended this famous conference, New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, in 2016, I think it was. And there was a strong opposition by the Darwinists against even this extended synthesis. People like Douglas Futuyma, who wrote the most well-known textbook on evolution. He's a staunch Darwinist. One of the co-authors of Josh's paper, Richard Lenski, is a staunch neo-Darwinist even. And if you look at all high school textbook or university 101 textbooks, they teach mainstream Darwinism. And there is a reason also why neutral theory isn't really popular in evolutionary biology. It's far from true that neutral evolution is some kind of reformation of Darwinism that solved the problem. First, it's very much unused in evolutionary biology in terms of macroevolution, because neutral theory cannot explain the origin of adaptive complexity. It can explain some phenomena in molecular evolution and cellular complexity. Just a moment. And that is also not just a claim from me. There has been a paper in 2018 when there was this 50-year anniversary of the neutral theory. It was in the Journal of Molecular Biology and Evolution, called The Neutral Theory in Light of Natural Selection. And here is just some notes about it. And that's a journal that is favorable to this whole thing. So from the outside, neutral theory was supported by unreliable theoretical and empirical evidence from the beginning. We can firmly reject its universality. A more comprehensive theory must be thought. It fared poorly. It has never been explanatory power, has never been exceptional. Original lines of evidence are now falsified. It has been overwhelmingly rejected. There's a reason why all these alternatives have not replaced neo-Darwinism in terms of macroevolutionary theory. If neo-Darwinism is false, then this whole thing is over. It's not like we have many other processes that could explain an undirected process. And also this question, what is direction? Because Josh asked, what do you mean by direction? Even in neo-Darwinism, selection gives some direction. That is not meant by a directed process. The question is it goal-directed? Does it have some end goal in mind? Is it developing towards something? And not is it just having some direction like the arrow of time. The arrow of time also has a direction. It only goes into the future, not into the past, but that doesn't mean that the time is going towards some predefined goal. And I think that is the crucial issue. Do we have evidence for goal-directedness in evolution?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I mean, so as I understand it, Joshua, Gunther's problem is that you're saying, hey, we've got more options than just the neo-Darwinian synthesis when it comes to understanding these gaps in the fossil record and other things. But Gunther's saying it's still the only game in town for a lot of people. You know, there's still dogged defenders of the Darwinian.
Well, I think that's a common misunderstanding, I think. I think that Gunther is talking in good faith. I don't think he's intentionally, misrepresenting anything. But you know, I mean, from my conversations with experts, my read of literature, and my work in this space, I just think that there's some big gaps in what's actually being proposed there. For example, I'm not saying that neutral evolution explains everything. I'm just saying that was the first major example that showed that the simple neo-Darwinistic story was incorrect in important questions. And since then, there's been a lot of other mechanisms proposed. One of them, which I think is particularly important for all of the biomolecular stuff relevant to irreducible complexity and all that, is constructive neutral evolution. And so that's where it's recognizing that neutral processes play important steps, but not all of the steps. Selection at times does become important. It's also related to particular features of how biology works, that that you don't know a priori, but you look at biological systems and you find out that this is how they work. That start to make it far more plausible. But here's the thing, too. I think this question of is it sufficient, all of these, is an important question. What I can tell you is that I don't think that they're sufficient to explain everything. I don't really know if any scientist thinks that they're sufficient to explain everything. If they did, we would stop doing scientific work there. There's major gaps in our knowledge, and we're studying them, and these sorts of mechanisms are giving a great deal of insight. But showing that a mechanism gives insight into how we got here, or you know how things evolved, doesn't rule out additional things working alongside it. What we know is that evolution is complex. We don't know all the details. And so I would, at the same time, I'm pushing back on ID, saying that by looking at an oversimplified model, they've shown that it's insufficient. I think that I'm also pushing back on atheists that say that science has shown that God hasn't been involved and that God wasn't necessary. We don't know that either. Really, science just isn't powerful enough, at least with what we know, or to kind of adjudicate that.
I just want to find out what your problem is with intelligent design specifically then, Josh, because you seem to say saying at some level, yes, I believe there's a sort of design of some sort going on in the process. So what's the problem with Gunther saying, so do I, and I call it intelligent design? Because whatever those processes are, it's got to have this goal-directedness to it. There's got to be an intelligence.
So you're right that on a lot of levels, it's not that big of a disagreement. But the issue is that I'm a scientist, and we, on a professional level, you know, it's not just about having the right conclusions. It's also about having the right... it's about having, you know, valid arguments to support them too.
Sure.
And so even a person you think is correct in their ultimate conclusions, but they're relying on invalid data, straw man views of a particular theory they're trying to disprove, or just making logical errors, you know, that's part of what scientists does, where you just are saying, well, that's not a convincing argument. Maybe A is true, but your argument for A is not valid.
Okay.
And I think that's a fundamental issue that keeps on coming up over and over again. It's not just a single argument. There's several cases like this in ID. Now, and it's not also everything. There are a few arguments that have been made by ID that I really do agree with.
Okay, Gunter, why don't you take it up from here? Firstly, you know, what's your response to some of what Josh has said there? I'd also really be interested in you kind of fleshing out one of these examples, say the issue of the way whale bone formation took place and why you think that doesn't
fit. That's certainly
fit, you
know, one example. Yeah. We can go into the details. One thing, because Josh mentioned constructive neutral evolution, and that's really an interesting idea. I think it can explain complexity of a certain type, and it can explain only this type of complexity, and that is complexity of the type like a Rube Goldberg machine. So when you have excessive, unnecessary complexity that is not helpful for the function, and that is actually even recognized in the specific technical literature on constructive neutral evolution, that it cannot explain the function. It has to presuppose the function, and then it can build complexity upon the function. But it cannot explain how do you build up complexity for a specific function. And even the examples that have been discussed in terms of these very excessively complex things in cellular biology and molecular biology, all the examples are very vague. There is another paper, also from 21, by Munoz Gomez, called Constructive Neutral Evolution 20 Years Later. And here is an interesting admission in this paper, direct quote: "Nevertheless, most, if not all, of these proposed examples for constructive neutral evolution remain speculative and await further evidence and detailed evolutionary narratives. There is not a single case where there is really a kind of well-documented case this has been built by constructive neutral evolution and that qualifies as some kind of complex mechanism that is having a specific function and not some kind of molecular Rube Goldberg machine." So I think it explains nothing that...
This is just pointing to the limits of science. There are certain things that...
No, it shows
are very
that this
difficult.
Process
when
is
you
not
get
an
down to the fine-grained details, it's very hard to, you know, about things that happened in the very distant past, very fine-grained details. Most of that stuff ends up being outside the streetlight. That doesn't mean the fact that we can't demonstrate directly all the details that it didn't happen. That's not how science works. That's just not how good epistemology works. Just because we don't see clear evidence one way or another, but we see observable evidence that's consistent with it, but it's not consistent with other things, that's good enough reason to at least provisionally adopt it. Now,
yeah,
I think the problem that happens,
the problem
that happens is that some people will take that provisional explanation as a total explanation. And that is a deep misunderstanding of science. And it happens quite frequently with some of the people you guys argue against. And I'm on your side on that. When you take a scientific explanation as the total established description of what's going on, that's a major error, both in science and in philosophy and epistemology, because that's just not what science does. It gives you the best provisional. And for them to make a very strong case that, for example, God is not needed in evolution, science does not show that. For them to make that case, they have to do an equivocation, really, between provisional and...
But that's not the argument on so many levels. So first, the question is not God, because intelligent design doesn't talk about God. The question is there empirical evidence for a kind of design signature in the data that is best explained by an intelligent cause, whatever this cause is? This could be aliens, or we could be living in the Matrix, or whatever.
Yeah, but see, that's precisely the part where I disagree, I guess.
Yeah,
like,
but then you have to go into the specifics, and the specifics, for example, with constructive neutral evolution, is not that we just don't know the details, and therefore we cannot rule out that it happened this way. The crucial argument is it cannot explain complexity, for example, like a bacterial flagellum. It is explicit in all the papers on constructive neutral evolution, that, and here is again a quote, it has to assume that the function was already there prior
Look,
to
I'm
the
I'm not
development
saying
of
that
complexity.
Constructive neutral evolution can explain everything. I'm saying that it can explain quite a bit more than you give it credit for. That's all I'm saying. And that it's also explicitly a non-Darwinian process. But that's beside the point. I think the key issue is that, you know, in the same way it's impossible to say that you've ruled out, you know, you've ruled out the ability for God to have intervened in evolution, and that's just a real dramatic overstatement. That purely materialistic view is not what science teaches. That's kind of basically a leap that, you know, an atheist has to make. And you know, they might make that leap, but it's not what the science is demanding them to do. I think at the same time, there's a similar sort of attempt to go from provisional partial to an unwarranted leap to really making a certain claim to rule out that not only all known natural processes can't account for this, but also unknown processes can't account for this. And I just don't think that that's a warranted leap. I think a far stronger position is to say that to have a principled uncertainty about it, to say that the evidence doesn't actually clearly discriminate between those cases.
Yeah, but that would imply that you are advocating a kind of naturalism of the gaps. Of course, we can never rule out any kind of unknown processes. There could be X that explains this, give us 200 more years, and then maybe we find X as explanation that could fill this gap of current knowledge. We have to look at the evidence that is available and look what is the best explanation for the evidence. And when we have excluded the only conceivable process that has ever been suggested, how could you build up complex information?
That's your minority opinion.
Please let
most scientists just don't agree that...
Let's allow Gunter to finish his thought. And I want to hear about whale bones as well, Gunter.
Yeah, definitely. Remind me if I should forget it. So, as I said, there's a reason why people so much emphasize, why are there three pillars of modern science? It's not neutral evolution and extended synthesis. It is quantum mechanics, theory of relativity, and Darwinism. That are the three pillars of modern science, because it was supposed that Darwin explained what previously was inexplicable unless you invoke some kind of design and creator. And therefore, the criticism of Darwin, because what you allude to is a kind of that we are committing the Sherlock Holmes fallacy. And Sherlock Holmes famously in some of the novels says, well, if we have excluded everything that is impossible, then whatever remains must be the truth, even if it is unlikely. And this would, of course, only be a fallacy if you cannot exclude all the other alternatives. That's what you suggest. There could always be some kind of natural other process that we don't know yet. But I would suggest if in 2000 years of Western thought, we have not any kind of other alternative that explains complex information from simple beginnings by a bottom-up process and by the stepwise process. None, as I said, none of the other process, neutral evolution, constructive neutral evolution, name it niche construction, evo-devo, phenotypic plasticity, whatever is discussed. All these processes either do not address the crucial problem of how do you get complex new specified information, or they don't solve it. There is nothing. There's a reason why people are desperately looking for some replacement for neo-Darwinism.
I got a question for you, Gunter. So you're a paleontologist. You understand the fossil record better than I do. What I find striking about this conversation, though, is that it seems like you're very reliant on the ID case that has nothing to do with the fossil record. It's primarily about things from Doug Axe, Michael Behe.
Some of it,
And so there. So here's my thought experiment. I just want you to, this is a counterfactual in your world, but just I want you to see if you can kind of enter this world with me, okay? What if they're wrong? What if it's just, and it's just not your area, so it's a little bit harder for you to untangle, but what if they're just wrong on all of those idea arguments for molecular mechanisms and all that? Wouldn't that substantially, damage your case?
the point is, of course, it could be that some of these ideas are wrong. As I said, it's a cumulative argument, and it could happen that some of these arguments maybe fail or turn out to be, let's say, incomplete or maybe totally false. But if I look at my own field, then I have to say every theory makes certain prediction, and Darwinism makes a Darwin's theory. And with this, I mean not just this particular process, but also including common descent with modification, makes a certain prediction how should transformations come about, and that is gradualism. Gradualism means that you can explain big differences by an accumulation of small differences, small changes over long periods of time. And this prediction is totally, utterly contradicted by the fossil record. And
yeah, and I think that mainstream scientists would agree with you on that.
Can I ask, just because I'm not a mainstream scientist, and a lot of people do have that high school 101 kind of view of Darwinian evolution, long periods of time, tiny gradual changes. Just explain for the layperson, Gunther, why that this makes no sense in your view of the fossil record. Maybe we'll get to those whale bones at this point.
So if we look at the fossil record, then most people may have heard of the Cambrian explosion and may think that is a maybe exception from the rule. But if we look in all groups of organisms in all periods of Earth history, from the very origin of life right at the first point in Earth history where life could exist after the late heavy bombardment, to the first origin of photosynthesis, to the first origin of macro fossils in the so-called Avalon explosion, the origin of these strange Ediacaran stuff, to the Cambrian explosion. And then there are later one phenomenon after the other that are called by mainstream evolutionists, revolutions, explosions, big bangs of blah, blah, blah. There's the Devonian Necton Revolution and the Siluro-Devonian Terrestrial Revolution and the abominable mystery of Darwin for the origin of flowering plants and the Big Bang of birds and the Big Bang of the genus Homo. And it's everywhere. And that we find these abrupt origins of new body plants, which do not leave the sufficient time for, let's say, on a population genetic level, to accumulate the necessary genetic changes in these windows of time.
Because look, there's a lot of information there. I just want to make sure everyone's following it and explain where and so we can kind of make sense of what's going on here. So first of all, there's a lot that I agree with what you're saying. So the naive view of Darwinism that was held for a long time was that you would see the gradual emergence of things and a generally smooth amount of phenotypic change over time. That's what was thought. That turns out not to be true. Like Stephen Jay Gould really talked a lot about punctuated equilibrium for this.
That's totally unrelated. That's a misunderstanding that is very common, maybe most common among non-paleontologists.
It is related to the same idea because that's the alternate explanation.
No, it's not actually gradual changes that we're seeing
in the phenotype.
I was about to bring up punctuated equilibrium. So Gunther, why isn't that a good explanation?
So punctuated equilibria, this idea by Eldridge and Gould, was never meant as a saltational theory to explain saltations in macroevolution. It was exclusively designed to explain discontinuity on one particular level, and that is species-to-species transition. That's on the most minor level of microevolution,
how you get
one dinoflagellate to another dino. Wait a moment. There's even a...
It's just a simple idea, is that phenotypic change will be relatively constant across geological timescales.
No.
And then at times it will have large shifts on geological timescales that are short. But a short geological timescale, like the Cambrian explosion, happens over at minimum 10 million years, but maybe up to 40 million years. I mean, that is a dramatically long period of time. though it's short. So when you say abrupt, it's...
If you don't understand it, then you have to let me respond to this, why this is abrupt. So if we look at windows of time, let's say 5 million years, 10 million years, then of course the average non-paleontologist would say, well, that sounds like a lot of time, let's say, compared to human history. There could a lot happen. So if you look at standard textbook knowledge, what is the longevity of a, let's say, species from its origin over its lifetime till its demise, either by extinction or dissolution into daughter species. There are times that have been calculated that differ, let's say, in larger vertebrates, it's about 2.5 to 4 or 5 million years. In invertebrate, marine invertebrates, it can be up to 10 million years. So if we have, let's say, a window of transition from a four-legged whale ancestor, to come back to the whale example, like Pachycetus, which basically looks like a kind of wild boar, to a fully marine whale like Dorudon or Basilosaurus, which for laymen looks like a dolphin or something, the available window of time is about 4.5 million years. That is, in comparison, the total lifetime of a single larger vertebrate species. According to mainstream evolutionists, there's a paper by Donald Protheroe, who is a prominent paleontologist critic of intelligent design, on the longevity of artiodactyl species, and whales are thought to be nested within the artiodactyl tree of life, and their longevity is about 4.5 million years. That means not, of course, that there could be just one speciation event in this time, but it gives you some idea why this time frame is still very abrupt, because you have a chain from a kind of wild boar to a dolphin-like animal in the lifespan of a single larger vertebrate species. That is a problem, but that is just...
No, not the lifespan. You're talking about the lifespan of a species, of not a an species. Individual.
Yeah, of course, but what changes but, happen on the species?
I think that's not how I understand that particular example is explained by evolution. It's not we can get into those details. That might be best to handle writing. I mean, honestly, I'm curious, Gunter. One thing I've appreciated about you is that you do care about dialogue. My interactions with you have always been in good faith, and you've always been kind to me in that way. And, you know, I was asking in Peaceful Science what questions to ask you. One question that came up is whether or not you'd be willing to dialogue more with some of the scientists there that have been reading your work and have some questions about your case. What? Well, not necessarily at Peaceful Science, but some other way to really kind of sort some of the stuff out.
Because what I have read at Peaceful Science is, let's say, it's still, you would have to improve this channel in terms of moderation to make it really...
No, it doesn't have to be at that site. I'm talking about those people. They're like, you know, we're scientists. We really want to engage.
Well, look, why don't we come back to this in just a second, folks? We're going to our final break.
Yes.
And we'll just have a chance to start to wrap up the conversation. It's been a fascinating one. I've really enjoyed hearing you both go at it today on intelligent design. My guests today are Dr. Gunter Beckley and Dr. Joshua Swamidas. We're talking about why one does and why one doesn't endorse intelligent design on Unbelievable today. Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. We always love it when you rate and review the podcast. If you're listening via the podcast, why not do that? People like Planet Wieners gave us 5 stars and said almost each time I'm talking to someone and they say, oh, that's interesting. How did you come to that conclusion? I can point back to this show as the genesis for my further study. So appreciate Justin's work in this and wish there were more Christians doing the same, initiating conversations with non-Christians instead of speaking ill of them. And other people got in touch to say the moderator does a great job bringing people together from opposing viewpoints to discuss their views in a calm way. This is unfortunately rare, but it's so needed in our world. We need to learn that people who we disagree with are not our enemies. And another says, great moderator, great topics, and great outlook. Check it out. It speaks for itself. Well, thank you so much, all those who have given those lovely reviews of the podcast. And if you want to add yours, it helps other people to discover the show as well. Still to come this evening here on Premier Christian Radio, Patrick Forbes is on the profile. He's a priest, broadcaster, and clown. And he'll be talking to me about his 80-plus years of ministry and faith, as told in his new biography, A Room Full of Elephants, and what a varied life he has had. So listen out for that tonight on The Profile, or indeed on its own Profile podcast. Next week here on Unbelievable, we conclude our Summer of Science with episode 5 of this season's Big Conversation. I'll be joined by noted physicist Paul Davies in conversation with another physicist, Jeremy England, who's also an ordained rabbi. Now, both of them have fascinating recent books out on the origins of life, and that will be our subject as we ask, do we need a new theory for how life began? So listen out for next week's Big Conversation with Paul Davies and Jeremy England. Right now, back into today's scientific discussion.
listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
It's been a fascinating time today on the show debating intelligent design from a biological perspective. And I don't know if you've followed everything when it comes to the science. There's been lots of talk of neutral evolution and, you know, the fossil record and things. But what I have enjoyed is the fact that both you, Joshua, and Gunther have been willing to sit down and have a, you know, a good discussion on this. Now, just first of all, before we start to wrap this program up, if people want more about Gunther and his work, Bechly.at is the website. That's Bechly.at. And peacefulscience.org for Josh. And Josh, you just in that last section, you were sort of issuing an invitation, and you just wanted to be clear about the purpose of this invitation and what it would involve.
I mean, so Peaceful Science has a forum, which is a great place to throw out stuff, but it's, you know, it's a rough and tumble place with, you know, scientists of a lot of different views. It's an open forum. It's not necessarily the best place for everything. I mean, we do have protected threads at times when we have people of your stature come, Gunther. But what I was talking about is different. I think that than inviting you to the forum per se. Rather, I think that there are scientists there that are legitimate scientists that that some of them are Christians, some of them are not, and you know, they want to engage with you to actually kind of start hashing out some of the details to figure out what really is a misunderstanding and what really is places where you could actually move to more agreement on things. And I think you know, the reality is yeah, this is a scientific conversation, but it's also connected to larger societal concerns. There's a reason why we're on. Unlike the vast majority of our scientific peers, we're here on Unbelievable because there are people outside of science that care about this conversation. And I think it really benefits the church, it really benefits society for us to really to see in what ways we can dialogue to really understand each other better and maybe even come to better points of consensus on things too.
Well, yeah, I'll leave
I
it
totally
to you
agree. Yeah.
Whether you want to take up that particular invitation, Gunther. What I mean, we've heard obviously the differences on scientific record and why you don't believe ultimately you can reconcile, you know, the data with a kind of Darwinian approach. And obviously Joshua said, well, there are more options on the table. And you've said, Gunther, well, I just don't think those options stack up to much at this point.
Right.
So you're happy for the moment to throw your hat in with intelligent design, Gunther. That's the most, I mean, what I frequently hear, of course, is intelligent design is a science stopper. It's not, you know, you're moving into simply saying God did it or something did it, and it kind of closes the whole area down. What I mean is that a concern of yours, Gunther? What's your response to that kind of typical response?
No, actually, design? I found the opposite. So the alternative would be some kind of methodological naturalism where you, let's say, a priori exclude certain hypotheses from the realm of options that you may choose from. And I actually find this a science stopper, that I'm not free to follow the evidence wherever it leads. I think this intelligent design method, the approach, is totally legitimate in a lot of fields. If it is forensics, where you want to find out was somebody killed or did he die from natural causes, or in archaeology, or in safety research, or there are a lot of fields where there's no debate that you can empirically detect and distinguish natural causes of chance and necessity from intelligent causation. So why not just look at the evidence and look, do we find hallmarks of design in cosmology, in elementary physics, or in biology? And if the evidence shows such thing, then you can conclude design. If not, that's fine as well. So it's not necessarily looking for design. It's looking what is the best explanation for the data. And in many cases, it can be perfectly fine to find only natural causes, also in biology. I think there's a reason why there is no intelligent design theory of chemics or of optics, or because these fields can be perfectly explained with simple laws that mathematically model what's going on. And I think there's a difference in historical sciences where by their very nature, you're dealing with singular events that cannot be easily mathematically modeled. And therefore, it's not just looking for natural processes that are following easy, simple equations or laws, but it could be, because that's typical for intelligent agents, that they make free will decisions which are not predictable mathematically. So in the historical sciences, I think looking for intelligent causation makes perfect sense, and then just look at the evidence. So I don't see it as a science stopper at all, and actually it changes what you look for.
And what's your problem then, Josh, with that approach? Because I see you desperately trying to reconcile two warring sides, you know, your atheist.
Well, I mean, I'm not desperate. I feel like it's been reconciled, but that's
okay. well, either
well,
way.
That's, you know, the ideas are reconcilable, but you're right. The two sides are not. Desperately trying to reconcile the sides.
And you yourself don't seem to be opposed necessarily to the concept of design. It's just intelligent design, as often understood, seems to be a real problem, because you say it's doing this confrontation thing with evolution, and from that point of view, it's an unhelpful way of trying to bring both sides together, in your view. But you don't seem necessarily to say design can never be plausibly involved at some level.
Well, I mean, it's not that I'm not necessarily opposed to it. I actually think that God was involved and he did design us. So I affirm design, intelligent design, with a lowercase I and D. I mean, I prefer to just say that God created us intentionally. But if we're going to use this parlance, we can say that. I think the issue comes to, you know, the specific arguments that are being made. I think, you know, I see the problem with concluding naturalism by naturalism of the gaps. But I also think that there's a real issue with concluding design from the gaps as well.
Sure.
I think the reality is, as a practicing scientist who is just having to make arguments from data all the time in my scientific work. I mean, I still have an active lab. I've been NIH funded, and most of the papers I write are on stuff that most people here wouldn't care about, which is fine. But you know, I'm kind of in the thick and thin of like, what actually is a good scientific argument? What actually is the data really confining us to? And where are the free points? And I just don't see the argument there in biology that really boxes us into either atheism or naturalism, or boxes us into design. So I think ID is really claiming that the argument, I mean, that the evidence does box you into having to conclude design. And I think that's, it doesn't exclude the idea of design, but it doesn't box you into it either. And I think it's an issue of just professional integrity as a scientist, to be clear about that. But then it also becomes a matter of how we engage with scientists who, when they look at the evidence, most of them come to the same conclusion I just said there, I think for very good reason. But why are we trying to debate with them and argue that this evidence boxes them into design when there's already space to affirm it? I don't understand that either, why that would be such a critical thing.
Because it's true. It's not the question of politics to box it into this for some, let's say, underlying political reason, because the question is it true? Is it the best explanation? And what you're suggesting, and which I have also seen in some of your talks, that you say, well, science leaves space to infer design. I'm actually more uncomfortable with this, because that to me suggests some kind of God.
Listen, what are you uncomfortable with? Can you state that again?
Yeah. I'm more uncomfortable with this view that you just say science leaves room for a design interpretation. It doesn't exclude it. It's not competing in a way with a design.
Why is that uncomfortable for you?
Because it suggests to me a kind of God of the gaps reasoning and a use. Let's say you would then say you believe in design, not because there is empirical scientific evidence, but because of faith. And that would be a kind of faith exactly in the bad definition of faith.
No. So I think you're misunderstanding. The reason why I affirm design is not because there's no evidence.
Let me just make finish this point. It would use this word faith in a way as it is used by many of the new atheists when they say, well, faith is just belief in the absence of evidence. And that's exactly what this would be.
That's not what I believe. I'm not a fideist. There's evidence for why design. I never said that there's no good reason or no evidence for it. And I talk about that evidence all the time. It's just that just because one line of evidence is strong doesn't mean that all lines of evidence are strong, right?
Sure, sure. That's true. So you wouldn't exclude, let's say, that intelligent design research is a valid scientific enterprise that could show empirical evidence for design. It's just that certain instances didn't convince you, or what is your position on that?
It doesn't matter what I would exclude or not. I mean, idea advocates can and have been able to do whatever they want to study this stuff. I think the issue is it a good scientific argument that's actually correct with the facts, that it's logically follows from one another, and it's actually doesn't go beyond the evidence. I think those that argue atheism from science are going beyond the evidence. I think what I observe of most people arguing from ID doesn't have to be this way. So an example of this is Bill Craig is a person who argues for design from nature, okay, focusing primarily on fine-tuning and the Kalam argument. I think he also is very clear that he doesn't care if his argument is considered scientific or not. He's using what makes his argument strong is that he goes from consensus scientific understanding. He's not actually disputing the science, but he's saying that this is the right way to interpret it, and he makes a very convincing case, I think, for design in a way that I think is actually not how ID does it. ID wants the argument to be considered science, and it's challenging the consensus, but Bill Craig has kind of taken that other approach, and I think that's actually a far more convincing approach, and I think it's valid, the argument that he's making, too. So that is an ID argument in a generic sense. It's a design argument, but I think it's a far more strong one than, for example, Michael Behe's argument.
Okay. Final thoughts as we start to draw this to a close. I'll give you first go, Gunter, and then back to Josh as we close out.
Yeah. So basically, I think our biggest difference, as we have seen, is this question, not, let's say, philosophically, is it possible, is ID science, or has it to be forbidden because of methodological naturalism? The question really is, do the design inferences in each particular instance, do they really back up what they claim to have found? Is there really empirical evidence for design or not? I would claim there is in a lot of different fields. That the design inference is the best explanation. And actually, I don't really see the big difference in the case of Bill Craig's argument. You have there the evidence from cosmological fine-tuning, where you have a clear pattern, which is typically fulfilling this ID criterion of being not only unlikely, but also pointing to an independently giving pattern, allowing for a life-permitting universe. And then you infer design. And if you want to find another explanation, then you have to go the multiverse route. But you cannot evade the necessity to explain this signature in the data. So I think it's a very similar argument as it was suggested by Bill Dembski or other design theorists. So I think there is solid evidence for design in molecular biology, in paleontology, in comparative morphology, from the whole realm of biology and natural history that is pointing to design and that is best explained by design, and not as a philosophical explanation or a theological explanation, but really as the best explanation of the data, if you allow for intelligent explanation and don't exclude them a priori as a kind of begging the question and not longer looking for truth, but just looking for natural explanation, even if they are incorrect. So I think intelligent design is a worthwhile enterprise, and then let's just follow the evidence wherever it leads.
Yeah. Final thoughts from you, Josh.
Well, I mean, thank you for having the conversation, Gunter. I think it's helpful. I do think I've understood your perspective better. I think, like I said, I think the core questions for people listening in, ironically, aren't about the science. I think what makes people animated and engaged in this conversation is of how science and what we're finding in nature really integrates with what God's revealed to us in Scripture. And so at some point, it would be really interesting to see more of your understanding of human evolution, why you're okay with common descent in that context, and how that fits in with Scripture. Because like I said, I think even though this is perhaps adjacent to ID, that is the sorts of questions that's bringing people to the table here. And that's a place where, even though you are an ID proponent, you actually agree with mainstream science on quite a bit there. And I think people would benefit a lot from hearing why.
Okay, sure. We certainly can have another debate about this if you want to. Yeah.
Well, look, maybe we'll leave that for another day. You're going to be joining us soon anyway, Joshua, on that particular issue with Bill Craig before too long. So it'll be interesting to hear both of your perspectives on the Adam and Eve story and how you're both attempting to reconcile that with Scripture. But for now, thank you so much for what's been a fascinating, informative and often lively debate between you both, Gunther and Joshua.
Well, was a pleasure. Thank you, Josh, for joining. And thanks, Justin, for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Justin. It's been a fun conversation.
The info for both of you is available from the website, beckley.at for Gunther Beckley, peacefulscience.org for Joshua. But for now, thanks for being with me and see you again soon. Look forward to hearing your thoughts about today's show. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave your thoughts on our Twitter, @UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account for the Unbelievable Show, or on Facebook, it's facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. You can also find me on Instagram at Justin.Briley, and indeed TikTok as well, where I like to put up some 60-second apologetic thoughts from time to time. Now, I sometimes get invited onto other people's podcasts as well to talk about the work I do, the Unbelievable book, and the Big Conversation, among other things. Recently sat down with Andy Bannister and Christy Mayer on the Persuasive Evangelism podcast from Solas. So if you're interested in checking that out, then do check out their podcast. That's the PEP podcast from Solas. Also sat down with the good folks at the Doubts Aloud podcast recently and had a good fun time debating with them on some of their questions about Christianity. And I'm due to feature as well soon on a YouTube show called Andrea with the Bangs, and that refers to her hairstyle, but she's a great interviewer, and you can see that as well. It's great fun to talk with all the different people on their various podcasts. I mean, in the time that I've been doing Unbelievable, you know, Unbelievable was somewhat unique when it started out as a podcast in terms of the conversations on faith and that kind of thing that we were developing. Now there are so many people doing great kinds of podcasts all over the world, so I'm glad to see the way that that whole area has really blown up in the last several years. We're going to hear some of your feedback now to recent editions of the show. And hello to Tristan, who says, I'm grieving with you the loss of your co-host Ruth. She hasn't died, Tristan. She's just got a maternity leave, but I appreciate your condolences. Hope you and yours are well, all things considered. I'm just about to finish reading Preston Sprinkle's Fight, says Tristan. I think it's about to be reprinted with a different title, and I just find his argument so convincing. I'd love to see you host a debate between a Christian perspective on Christians and violence, and whether Jesus' teaching allows for the use of violence in war, self-defense, etc. I think someone like Preston or Greg Boyd or Shane Claiborne would be an excellent debater for the non-violent position, though admittedly, I don't know who would represent the other side of the debate. Perhaps that's what I'm wanting, is someone to really challenge these strong claims. Do you have any people or resources you'd recommend to challenge the Christocentric non-violent position? I love recommending your podcast to friends, and when I have this conversation about a Christocentric non-violent position, I've often found myself wishing I had an episode from your show I could send people as a primer for our conversation. Well, it's probably time we did do this again, because if you go far enough back in the archives, Tristan, and I'm trying to think, this is probably back to 2014, I think November 2014, we did this particular issue with two people who were probably, you know, two of the best known people in this area, and they are Stanley Hauervass, who was arguing for the non-violence position, and Nigel Bigger, who's one of the foremost academic Christians in the world, arguing for sort of a just war kind of view in Christian terms. So that's a good place to start, maybe back in the archives. November, I think it's November 2014 that we did that, that whole question of non-violence and Christianity pacifism on the show. But some great names and suggestions there for us taking that one up again. Thank you very much for getting in touch with the program. Thanks to all of those who have been in touch as well on the many programs we've been airing recently with lots of interesting different stuff. So obviously we've been doing a lot of science over the past few weeks. Stephen C. Meyer and Brian Keating on the Return of the God Hypothesis last week were talking about Big Bang cosmology and that kind of thing and whether it's evidence for God. Lots of interest on this on Twitter. Here's just a couple though. Chris Song said, thank you, huge fan Justin, and thanks to Brian and Stephen. Wonderful discussion. Isn't the strongest argument, and one that as a non-physicist I hear in your arguments, the old one, that something cannot come from nothing? How does a multiverse ultimately address that? And Thomas said, Maya is a great mind. I enjoyed watching the video and hyper-intellectual conversation. We need more of these sorts of critical conversations. Yeah, it did get pretty technical at points, didn't it? But it's one of those advantages. If you are listening on podcast, you can rewind and listen again to see if you can catch up. And the week before, of course, Sabina Hossenfelder and Luke Barnes debated, was the cosmos made for us? It was fine-tuning that was being debated on that. And again, lots of interaction on Twitter for that one. Here's some of what you said. Master Yoda tweeted, I'm a huge fan of Sabina, was looking forward for this conversation, but I'm a bit disappointed by her approach. Maybe I didn't understand correctly, but not looking for further explanations and accepting things as brute facts seems contrary to the scientific endeavor. And that's a theme that comes across a lot in some of these responses. People feeling that Sabina, who said, you know, ultimately the question of whether there is a creator and that kind of thing, whether fine-tuning points beyond itself is not a scientific question. They weren't very satisfied with that. Les says, I listened to the debate. Sabina's position is that every question must have a scientific answer, and this is self-contradictory. Peter Kay said, this was one of the most puzzling shows. Sabina's answer to the title question essentially was, I don't know, I don't care, it's not science. Okay, but then why even be on the show? What's the point? Daniel Wackham, on the other hand, says the problem is, well, he quotes firstly Sabina, who said this, the problem is that many scientists are making metaphysical arguments but don't know it. They're not aware of what they're doing. And Joachim Daniel said, great insight from Sabina on this week's Unbelievable. The last decades are littered with examples of this. I thought that both she and Luke Barnes spoke somewhat past each other, ending up on a conclusion that Luke Barnes also basically agrees upon, that the fine-tuning argument should not be understood as a purely scientific hypothesis. And Seth got in touch to say, how might we make strong teleological arguments without needing to rely on this or that unusual physical parameter? Hossenfelder is the first person I've seen to just claim there's nothing to explain. And over on Instagram, people were getting in touch about it as well. Feeds Reads Deeds said, I listened to this episode walking yesterday, so interesting, but felt like Sabina Hossenfelder just couldn't engage in the broader philosophical dialogue as it was outside her field of expertise. Thank you very much for getting in touch. And also Rebecca J. Bromley, who got in touch on that thread and said, I've loved finding the podcast this year. Such good conversations and so many unexpectedly nice and gracious people having them. The generosity of guest and moderator is the really inspiring part as much as the topic. N.T. Wright and Tom Holland, Abril and all the others. So glad I stumbled across this. Thanks for what you do. Thank you very much, Rebecca, for Instagramming me your thoughts and praise for the show. Others who have got in touch on the Sabina and Luke episode include Harry Allen, who actually writes this directly to Sabina Hossenfelder. I don't know if Sabina has replied to you, Harry, but this is what you had to say. I'm a fan, Sabina. Three questions, though, based on listening to your conversation with Luke Barnes. Firstly, how does the border separating science and philosophy move? For example, the way star composition became a science, despite philosopher Auguste Comte's prohibitions after spectroscopy. You said this does happen. If so, what turns philosophy into science, or vice versa? In other words, what generally clearly statable operating principle does this? Second question for Sabina here. Why aren't these scientific questions, such as why are the laws of the universe as they are? Why are the values of the constants as they are? Why is there a universe? In other words, the constants, the universe, and the laws of it are scientific phenomena. So why aren't questions about what processes result in constants, laws, or a universe scientific? And thirdly, you said the universe has to be some way, and it's the way that we observe. That's just a fact. Well, question one, is that a scientific fact or a philosophical fact? That is, your statement is not falsifiable. It's always true, whether one is Cro-Magnon or whether one is whoever makes us forget Edward Witten ever existed. So question two, how would one express that statement scientifically? And if it cannot be done, is it part of science? There you go. Some searching questions for Sabina Hossenfelder from Harry Allen. Thank you very much for sending, for including me in the email to Sabina as well, Harry. And Matthew Taylor from the Still Unbelievable podcast wanted to say, in the recent episode on fine-tuning, Luke rather spoilt his hand right at the beginning of the episode when he affirmed that the apparent fine-tuning of the universe doesn't necessarily require a god. I think it's great when those who are science trained are cautious about declaring conclusions which aren't soundly supported. If only the lay Christians would get that memo. And Gareth Nash said, what I admired most about Sabina's methodological naturalist approach, though, was her cautious agnosticism. She was careful not to traverse the border that separates scientific quantifiability from philosophical speculation. Too often, atheist physicists such as Krauss, deGrasse Tyson, and Weinberg make philosophical assumptions about the nature of the universe that argue against the putative omnibenevolence of a grand designer. Since why would God create a universe in which the vast majority of it is hostile to life? Why make a universe far bigger than the solar system, therefore? Interestingly, the very question itself already presupposes the identification of a grand designer with an omnibenevolent one. Nonetheless, the objection is philosophical, not scientific. To the layperson, however, it may seem that since such statements are made by scientists who are experts in their chosen fields of research, they are scientific statements. But these are precisely the kind of assumptions alluded to by Luke that one wishing to establish scientific objectivity must guard against. Well, thank you very much for some of those responses to our recent shows on the universe. There's been a lot of other responses as well to other shows, but we'll save some of those over for next time. For now, thank you very much for being with me on today's edition of the show, and look forward to your responses to this week's show on intelligent design in biology. Don't forget that coming up soon, coming up this evening on Premier Christian Radio, it's The Profile. My guest this week, Patrick Forbes, priest, broadcaster and clown, and you can hear that on its own Profile podcast. But right now, let me tell you what's coming up this time next week. Well, here on Unbelievable, we'll be concluding our Summer of Science with episode 5 of this season's Big Conversation. I'll be joined by noted physicist Paul Davies in conversation with another physicist, Jeremy England, but who's also an ordained rabbi, interestingly. Now, both of them have recent fascinating books out on the origins of life, and that's going to be our subject. Do we need a new theory for how life began, and how does God tie into it all? We'll hear what Paul Davies and Jeremy England have to say. Hope you can join us for that same time next week. For now, thanks for being with us.